Blog Talk Radio.
Healing rain is coming down. It's coming nearer to this old town. Rich and poor, weak and strong, it's bringing mercy. It won't be long. Healing rain is coming down. It's coming closer to the lost and found. Tears of joy and tears of shame are washed forever in Jesus' name.
On this International Women's Day, we celebrate the 20th anniversary of a landmark agreement in the struggle for women's rights. The Beijing Declaration and Platform for Action gave the world a powerful statement of principle. Women's rights are human rights. And it gave us a clear roadmap to gender equality and the empowerment of the world's women and girls. There has been dramatic progress. More girls have more access to more education than ever before. Nearly half as many women die in childbirth. More women are leading businesses, governments, and global organizations. Yet too many girls and women are still targets of domestic abuse, female genital mutilation, and other forms of violence. Discrimination remains a thick glass ceiling. We need to shatter it together. We need the resources to get the job done. But most of all, we need to change our mindset, especially among men. This is the United Nations 70th anniversary. We will adopt a new set of sustainable development goals and the meaningful Universal Climate Agreement. The world will never realize 100% of its potential if 50% of its people are held back. Let us do more to empower the world's women, starting now.
That is the Secretary General of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, proclaiming International Women's Day. Hi, my name is Randy L. Noble. I'm the host of The Cross in the Desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. So glad that you could join me this morning on the Monday morning edition of The Cross in the Desert. Yesterday was International Women's Day, March 8th, 2015. And I really wanted to put together a program to talk about the ongoing struggle of women against honor violence, honor killings, acid attacks, discrimination, gender inequality. And this is an issue near and dear to my heart. As an author, I write about Iran. I write about the struggle for my Iranian friends, and most of them being women. They articulate very well in the stories of my book, The Cross in the Desert, of what it's like to live under an oppressive government. Well, just this year, I'm starting a new pathway on the subject of women's rights. I'll be writing a new book in just the next month. I'll begin writing anyway. It's called Prisoner of Her Culture, Sakina's Fight for Freedom. And I'm going to take the reader this year to Pakistan and talk about forced marriage and talk about honor killings. The story will take place in part in Pakistan and also here in the United States. But that's all I want to share with you. I don't want to give away all the plot line and storyline to you just yet. But just to give you an idea, I am committed to the protection of women and the violence done against women. And one of the very best documentaries on the subject of violence against women in Muslim-controlled countries is Honor Diaries. And we're going to be featuring a little bit of information later on about some facts you need to know about defining honor violence here in the West and why it matters, and talk about the trends in honor killing. International Women's Day, as Ban Ki-moon mentioned, it's a 20-year anniversary of the beginning of this movement in Beijing. He did mention a few of the accomplishments, but we're still in a very long, hard fight to see women finally free from the shackles of male-dominated societies. And so the purpose on today's program is to educate you. We're going to have several sound bites of those that have survived honor killings. But what I want to do to begin this very special day, to celebrate the great women in the world, Iranian, Middle Eastern, Malaysian, whoever they may be, I first have to talk about the statistics and the facts. There's still way too much violence going on. We still have much, much more hard work to do to fight this beast, to fight this discriminatory beast against women. What I want to do right now, I want to take some time to lay a groundwork for honor killings. We hear about it all the time in the Middle East, places like Pakistan, Afghanistan, Saudi Arabia, but we don't hear as much here in the United States, but that has changed in the last couple of years. What I want to do is talk to you about some recent cases and educate you about how honor killings are on the rise here in the United States. We're going to listen to this first report right now on the cross in the desert.
The practice of honor killings tragically occurs in other parts of the world, but is almost unheard of here in the United States. Until a case of a young woman in Arizona that had some wondering if the practice may have moved here. 48 Hours mystery correspondent Troy Roberts explains.
It was in this Peoria, Arizona parking lot that 48-year-old unemployed truck driver Fala Amaliki, a married father of seven, a man with no criminal record, rammed his Jeep into two women. Amaliki sped away from the scene, leaving the two severely battered women on the pavement. Eyewitness Shunil Nakamoto.
I heard just the sound of an engine speeding up, just vroom. I heard a thud. I saw a girl laying in the rocks, face down.
One of Amaliki's victims was his 20-year-old daughter, Noor. According to investigators, she had left an arranged marriage in Iraq several years earlier and had moved out of her parents' home after constant fighting about her lifestyle. The attack left Noor in a coma. 2 weeks later, doctors pronounced her clinically brain dead. Her family took her off life support.
The mystery is why, and what would possess a father to do something like this to his daughter.
Investigators believe that Noor Amaliki may have been the victim of an honor killing.
When a young woman strays from what her family expects and she tries to stand up for what might be her legal rights, her family may react, retaliate by killing her or hurting her in order to avenge her misbehavior and clean its own honor, redeem itself in the face of the community.
Primarily occurring in parts of the Middle East, South Asia, and North Africa, cases of honor violence are now being found in Europe, Canada, and the United States. Experts have no handle on the exact number of cases, but worldwide, the UN estimates that at least 5,000 women are murdered each year in the name of honor.
You know, you can talk to me.
Jasvinder Sangera works with survivors of forced marriages and honor crimes.
Nowhere in Islam, Sikhism, or Hinduism, in any of the major faiths, does it say this is acceptable. Honor is man-made. It's a oppressive cultural practice.
As for Fala Amaliki, he was charged with first-degree murder in the death of his daughter Noor, one of the first honor killings in the United States to be prosecuted. Amaliki chose not to testify, but his attorneys argued that it was all just an accident. He never meant to kill his daughter. For 48 Hours Mystery, I'm Troy Roberts, CBS News, New York.
These are killings that just shock us. How can this go on? What is behind honor killings? What is this really all about? Well, one of the best ways to be educated about this practice is to see the powerful documentary, Honor Diaries. And as I perused their website, I came across some fact sheets that I think are helpful for you and me to get a handle, an understanding of really honor violence and what it is all about and what's the motivation behind it. So honor-based violence is violence against an individual who, quote, has dishonored their family. Victims of honor violence are targeted because their behavior violates cultural or religious norms. Now, the assailant feels that the only way to restore family honor is to harm or kill the victim. And you hear the stories just like this one. Victims are often shot, stoned, burned, buried, alive, strangled, smothered, and stabbed. And that's all done in the name of restoring honor. Now, honor violence is a widespread phenomenon that represents the most horrific outcome of a patriarchal, honor-based society in which honor is considered more important than human life. Honor-based violence in Europe and North America has become more common due to an increasing amount of immigrants from honor-based communities. Now, let's look a little bit at the statistics for trends in honor killing. Honor violence in the West follows similar trends as honor violence in the East. It is considered dishonorable for an immigrant from an honor-based culture to assimilate into a Western society. So you hear oftentimes that the reason why this honor violent killing took place is because this girl became too immersed in Western values. This is the same norm with my friends in Iran. They are dissuaded from getting on the internet because they will adopt Western ideas or Western values. And so it's dishonorable for that culture, for any of the members of that culture to assimilate those kinds of values. Now, families and spouses use emotional and physical violence to force women to conform to their community's traditions and cultural norms. And so what happens here, if you can think with me, the family itself becomes like God. You don't dare disagree. You don't get a job at this place. You don't try to even get involved in this relationship because it has to be what the family has decided. Now, where is honor violence taking place? It's occurred in Europe, North America, and Canada. In Europe and North America, 97% of honor-based violence victims are young women from South Asian and Middle Eastern communities. And in the UK, there was more than 2,800 incidents of honor-based violence reported to the police, and there are at least 12 honor murders a year. And it's amazing how this continues to rank. This is statistics from 2011 in the UK. Up to 17,000 women in Britain are subjugated to honor-based violence every year. In the Netherlands, there are around 12 honor killings reported, with 400 to 600 honor violence reported annually. It's amazing how these statistics just boggle the mind. In Germany, there are about 12 honor killings annually reported there. In Canada, in just the year 2011, there were 40 cases of honor-based violence. I remember when I go up on YouTube and find stories, I'm amazed that I'm finding these stories taking place in Canada. At least 1,000 women have been victims of honor-based violence crimes in the country of Finland. In Turkey and Sweden, in order to be technically innocent of murder, families forced the dishonored woman to commit suicide. It's unbelievable. These statistics are found on the honordiaries.com website. I'm sure they're periodically updated, but give you an idea of what we're dealing with here. And this is a phenomenon we thought was just located in the Middle East. Well, it's made its way here to the United States with many, many cases that have boggled our minds. As we look on the news and hear about, like, for instance, the story I just played for you, the honor-based violence killing in the state of Arizona. Well, you would think there's no hope for these victims. There are those victims that do manage to escape and survive an honor killing. And one such was a young lady in Pakistan named Gul Mina. And let's hear her amazing story right now on the cross in the desert.
Slouched over in a chair, her sullen eyes staring at the ground, Gul Mina is a teenager filled with shame. Pulling back her pretty headscarf, she reveals deep scars across her face. Her 17 years, a life of pain and suffering. My family married me off when I was 12 years old, she tells me. My husband was 60. Every day he would beat me. I would cry and ask him to stop, but he just kept on beating me. This small, fragile girl pleaded with her parents to help, but they refused. My family would hit me when I complained. They told me, you belong in your husband's house. That is your life. After 5 years of abuse, Gulmina finally gathered the courage to leave her husband in Pakistan, running away with a young Afghan man to Jalalabad across the border 5 months ago. But according to strict Islamic customs, this is the ultimate crime. I knew my husband and family would be looking for me. I knew we were in danger. Days later, her brother tracked them down. Armed with an axe, he hacked to death Gulmina's friend and then struck his own sister 15 times, cutting open her face, head, and parts of her body.
She has bad tendencies. What about on your face? Do you have pain in your face?
Oh, that's just okay.
Yes.
Left for dead, Gulmina was brought to the emergency department of this hospital by a stranger. With part of her brain hanging out of her skull, neurosurgeon Dr. Khalid held out little hope. We took her to the operating theatre and she'd already lost a lot of blood. Her injuries were horrific and her brain had been affected. We didn't think she would survive.
Due to the life-saving treatment by the doctors and staff at this hospital, Gulmina miraculously survived. But the problem was who would care for her, considering her family had disowned her. Now, the government and authorities knew full well that she was here, but due to the stigma and circumstances, they wanted nothing to do with her.
For 2 months, she stayed in this hospital, doctors donating money to pay for her medicine. Finally, a women's organization took her in, giving her the love and care she so desperately needed. Gulmina is one of thousands of women living in shelters across Afghanistan, many of them victims of attempted honor killings. And while they try to start a new life, for this uneducated, frightened girl, it's going to be an enormous struggle.
And if we send her to her family, she's going to be killed. I mean, as far as the family is concerned, she's dead.
And at times, Gulmina wishes she was, having attempted suicide several times since arriving at the shelter. I want to kill myself, but they won't let me. When I look at the mirror, I put one hand to the side of my face. People tell me not to do that, but I'm so ashamed. Anna Corrin, CNN, Kabul.
Just an incredible story. Gulmina has not only physical scars from this attempted honor killing, but also internal hidden scars underneath in her heart and mind, causing such depression and such shame that she has even attempted to commit suicide, even after being transferred to a woman's shelter. So the scars run so much deeper than what is seen on the face in these attempted honor killings. There is some hope in these situations, not much hope, because there are so many instances where women and men as well don't survive these horrific honor killings in the family situation. But Gulmina is one such person, but she deals with the deep scars and pains brought on by these attempted honor killings. I have another story here reported by the BBC News about another honor killing attempt and a survivor. We're going to listen to that right now on the cross in the desert.
These happy newlyweds, Sabah and Kaiser, are trying to put the past behind them. But her scars make it hard to forget. Just a few weeks ago, she quietly married the love of her life against the wishes of her family. The day after the marriage, Sabah's father and uncle took her from her new home and tried to kill her. Sabah told me that she didn't think she would survive.
It was a dark and moonless night. When they stopped the car by the canal, I asked them, "What are you going to do?" They slapped me and fired at me. They wanted to kill me. And when one bullet passed through my hand, they fired again. This time it grazed my cheek, and that's when I fainted. They threw me into the canal. It was only when I hit the water that I came around. I grabbed a hold of some weeds and pulled myself out.
Her father, Maqsood Ahmed, and her uncle are being held in this jail on charges of attempted murder and kidnap.
I just met with Sabah's father, Maqsood, here in the central jail, Gujranwala. We weren't allowed to take any recording equipment with us into a small closed room. Behind bars, he said he had not committed any crime. He just wanted to teach his daughter that no girl in his family should ever elope.
But in Pakistan, while nearly 900 honor killings were reported last year, such crimes often go unpunished.
The law, unfortunately, is very flawed and weighed in favor of impunity for honor killings, because in most cases it would end in a compromise, because the family will first conspire to kill the woman and then conspire to get into a compromise and forgive the person who has actually pulled the trigger.
Negotiations are already underway for an out-of-court settlement. Saba says she doesn't want to forgive her family, but her in-laws and community elders are pressuring her. Since the attempt on her life, Saba has met neither her mother nor her siblings. She says she'll never go back to her family. Her scars are healing, but it is unlikely that they will fade. Amber Shamsi, BBC News, Gujarawala.
Saba is another example, like Gulmina, that the scars underneath the skin that you cannot see is far more painful than the scars that you can see above the skin. And these are very desperate girls trying to rebuild their lives after being subjected to attempted honor killings. And so Saba and Gulmina are two examples of hope in honor killings, those that have survived but have a long battle ahead of them dealing with the emotional deep scars from within. As you know, I have a new book out called The Cross in the Desert, Speaking Hope and Freedom to Iran. And of course, there are stories in here from my Iranian friends that they've shared with me about the struggles they have for the rights of women living behind the Islamic Republic of Iran, that iron curtain of oppression and fear. And a couple of years ago, I wrote a book called The Rose of Nowruz, which was the story of a young Iranian girl who becomes a freedom fighter and champion for women's rights in Iran. And in that story, I had a little story within it, something that Behera, my main character, wrote as she waited for the bus, talking about her being a woman, that she's more than just a veil. Well, I want to read to you Atafi's story of how she's treated as a woman in Iran and her feelings and emotions that go into it. So I want you to hear this as it relates to International Women's Day here on The Cross in the Desert. 2 years ago, I had the privilege of writing a very special book on the rights of women for my Iranian friends entitled The Rose of Nowruz, Dreams of Hope and Freedom. My dear friend Atafi, who lives in Tehran, shared her powerful story with me that became the basis of the storyline for my book. Since its publication, The Rose of Nowruz has been read by prominent human rights groups, Iran and Canada, including my dear friends who live in the heart of the Islamic Republic. Just recently, I asked Atafi to write a short, personal reflection on the treatment of women in Iran. She happily agreed. I want you to read word for word, or listen, in this case, word for word, to her feelings and convictions. My Iranian friend is an English teacher and has an amazing gift of describing from her heart the way of life in the Islamic Republic of Iran. The following short paragraph is her latest story reflecting on the treatment of women in Iran. Quote, security. The word sounds familiar to many people around the world, but for me, that's not tangible. I would love to feel it one day, if I get the chance, and I hope no woman in the world feels the insecurity I'm coping with here. Everywhere else, women are praised for their beauty, all the sacrifices they do for the family and for bringing life into the world. But here, when it comes to women, there are no rights, no values. Women are things which must be used. The worst thing about this inequality is that you have to feel it every day from the bottom of your heart. The simplest example that I can mention is standing at a street corner waiting for a taxi. Just because of standing there, every cab driver or motorcyclist feels free to honk the horn, stop next to you, and begin flirting with you, saying nasty things to you. It is a reminder that every day you are being treated like an object created to make life full of pleasure for men. It really doesn't matter whether you are single or married, well-dressed or not, having a complete hijab or not. What I'm describing happens to every Iranian woman every single day. It is very devastating to experience being watched and harassed from the moment that you leave home until the time that you arrive at your destination. They feel free to whisper whatever dirty and nasty things that they wish. They feel free to comment on your face and body and even the minute things that you never noticed in the mirror. Narrating and elaborating this issue really makes me sick of being a woman here. I bet you could never tolerate a single day here. And that is Atafi's story. Well, while it's true that in my culture, flirting and harassment of women is also a problem, in Iran, it's a way of life resulting from the teachings of the Quran and the Hadith. Some of my Muslim friends insist the Quran is a book that highly praises the equality of women, but when carefully read, it contains statements that seem to teach quite the opposite. For example, Surah 2:223 declares, quote, your women are your fields, so go into your fields whichever way you like. Reflecting back on my friend's description of the harassment and flirting of men, it is now understandable why she is treated this way in everyday life. This verse from the Quran essentially is giving permission for the man to treat his wife in a lewd, sexual, and vulgar way. Another example, Surah chapter 4, verse 11 states, quote, the share of a male shall be twice that of a female, end quote. The Quran is very clearly teaching that when it comes to the issue of inheritance rights, the man is preferred over that of a woman. One more example, the Hadith, which is the collection of the sayings and deeds of the Prophet Muhammad. Volume 1, Book 6, number 301 states, the Prophet says, isn't the witness of a woman equal to half that of a man? The women said, yes. He said, that is because of the deficiency of a woman's mind. You can now clearly feel and understand why my dear Iranian friends suffer from this type of abuse and harassment every day. Atafi's culture has been taught that men are superior to women, and they are permitted to treat them as mere sexual objects. Instead of treating women with dignity, honor, and respect, men engage in perverse behavior and treat them as mere possessions for their amusement and entertainment. This is the cultural mindset that my dear friends have to cope with every day. But in contrast to the Quran, the Bible portrays women with dignity and respect as the image bearers of God. Women were treated with compassion and kindness by Jesus during his earthly ministry. In the Jewish culture, women suffered from much of the same treatment, and Jesus came on the scene treating women with the worth and dignity that they deserved. Proverbs chapter 31, verse 10 is a perfect example of showing high to the value and worth of women. The writer King Lemuel asks the question, quote, an excellent wife, who can find? She is far more precious than jewels. Verse 25, she is clothed with strength and dignity. Verse 26, when she speaks, her words are wise, and she gives instructions with kindness. Life is hard for women in Iran. They are daily scrutinized by the morality police, making sure they are wearing their hijabs properly, and if not, they can be arrested and fined. In my book, I describe this in much more detail. My heart goes out to my dear Iranian friend. Atafi needs to be treated with dignity and respect. Women are not possessions, quote, rather they are image bearers of God, of great worth and value that deserve to be treated with tenderness and kindness. God, not government, defines the value and worth of a woman. She is much more than just a veil. Amen. And on this International Women's Day, looking back to yesterday, which was the official day, dignity, value, worth, honor is what rightly describes a woman. She is to be protected with such. Last night, my wife and I were watching Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. And in the ending scene when the evil sheriff of Nottingham had captured Robin Hood's woman friend. I can't remember her name right now. It's terrible, isn't it? But anyway, there is this fight to the finish, this sword fight between Robin Hood and the sheriff for the honor and the worth of this woman. And I was thinking, chivalry is not dead. And that's the same way that women need to be cherished and protected and treated within this day and age, with honor, with respect, with dignity. And so I was just reflecting on that scene last night, and of course Robin Hood triumphed and killed the sheriff and won the hand of this woman. And it just goes to show you the way women should be portrayed. We should fight for them. We should protect them. We should honor them. We should cherish them. Well, educating us about honor killings and violence done against women is something that's so important, and that's one of my purposes on today's program. But there is one such powerful documentary that came out over a year ago. In fact, the year anniversary is coming up, actually. That came out over a year ago that really uncovers and displays how women are treated in Muslim-dominated countries and how Muslim women activists are speaking out against honor crimes against women. And I'm talking about the powerful documentary Honor Diaries. If you haven't had an opportunity to see it, you must do it. It is a must viewing for your Bible school, for your church, for your women's group. This is a very educational film that does provide ways and answers for us to remedy this problem. So what I want to do right now, I want to feature the trailer, a clip from this movie, just to give you a taste of what Honor Diaries is all about. We're going to listen to it right now on the cross in the desert.
My sister was telling me how unhappy she was in her marriage, and I said to her, come to me. She said, I can't, because I have to think about honor. She didn't want to dishonor the family by leaving her husband. In the end, she set herself on fire. Rabina did, and she died.
The concept of honor, it's very difficult to explain it to Western societies.
Honor is something that is carried and contained in women and is there to be guarded by men.
Anything from wearing short sleeves, refusing to wear a headscarf, being seen talking to a man,
those things can be deemed dishonorable.
Thousands of women have been detained for dressing un-Islamically. Like this woman screaming as she's pushed into a police car.
The honor system in Muslim-majority societies is really the basis of a lot of harm that is perpetuated against women.
It's systematic, institutionalized misogyny.
I was crying and begging him to stop. Then he put his hand on my mouth like this. I couldn't breathe. I was crying. But he used me anyway.
The issue of forced marriages, child marriage, and honor abuse is a worldwide problem.
When you do dissent with what is portrayed as mainstream belief, you are ostracized. There are threats of murder, there are threats of rape, physical mutilation.
It's important to talk about what happens physically so that every human being, male and female, understand that the genitals of the female are cut.
We don't need sympathy, empathy, pity. We need systematic change in the Muslim world.
From Bahrain to Egypt, women have raised their voices and their fists in demanding universal rights.
People of all backgrounds can make a difference.
My sisters in solidarity, there has never been a better time than now to turn the tide.
We need a whole army of women helping other women.
We will speak up for our rights and we will bring change to our world.
A very, very powerful documentary, Honor Diaries. My good friend Zainab Khan, who's been on the cross in the desert a few times, is also featured in this film, as well as Nazanin Afshin Jam, who was on the cross in the desert just last summer. And she is also featured in this powerful film. Another one of my friends, Wakrell Avita Saraswati, is also featured in it. It's a film that has been released almost a year ago. I think it's a year anniversary that just happened a couple of days ago. But it has really reaped a lot of great, great fruit, as we say. A lot of good feedback, a lot of good reaction to the film. There's been criticism, of course, especially by CARE, that is the organization, the Islamic organization with relationships with other groups called CARE. They have said that somehow this demeans Islam, and of course it doesn't. These are Muslim women who are courageously speaking out against the atrocities that are committed in the name of their religion, and they're saying this needs to change, the laws need to change. And of course, I agree, in countries like Pakistan, where men come out on the winning side in the crimes against women because of the law, because of the traditions, the tribal customs in Pakistan, we must seek ways to change that law, especially last May, it's been almost a year, when a young girl who decided to go against the family norm, I think her name is Parkveen, I believe her name was, and she decided to go against the norm. Her family had an arranged marriage or a forced marriage, and she said no to that, and she instead married someone else. Well, what happened is that because the family said that you can't do that, one day as she was going to the courthouse, I think it was in Lahore, and they met her outside of the courthouse and publicly stoned her to death. And of course, this made news all over the world. But this happens pretty regularly in Pakistan, as well as acid attacks. And so the only way to make a difference in these countries is not only speaking out and praying, of course, is what I do, but you must physically go in there and work with the government to change the laws. And that is no easy task, because of tradition, because of honor, because of customs. And this is something that's so sad, that all of these so-called family values triumph and go against what is true and triumph over what is right. These values are so mandated in these societies. As I mentioned to you, honor violence is because a family member has gone against the grain. They've decided to do things their own way and decided against what the family wants them to do. And because of that, they're punished. They feel that the only way to correct this situation is to physically punish them, because in their mind, they have not only dishonored the family, they've dishonored Allah. And of course, the honor and shame that comes into this culture dominates these countries like Pakistan and India and Afghanistan and Saudi Arabia. But Honor Diaries has been out for over a year and is educating most people about this practice. There are some people that are so sheltered in the news, they're not even aware that this actually happens, but it does. And so I'm thankful to the producer of Honor Diaries for making this film and making it available to educate us about honor violence against women all over the world. Well, we've talked a little bit about some of the survivors of honor violence, but one great example of this, who's really a hero for me, is Malala Yousafzai. Of course, Malala Yousafzai in October of 2012 was shot by the Taliban simply because she wanted education for women in Pakistan, and they shot her on a bus, and she miraculously survived this, of course, honor killing, or fatwa against her. And since then, she has written two books, and she's a world symbol for hope for women in Pakistan and all over the world for education. And so I wanted to take you to one of the most powerful speeches I've ever heard. And this was Malala's United Nations speech back in July of, I believe, 2014, if I'm not mistaken, where she turned 16. And on her birthday, she came to the United Nations and gave a speech about her recovery from the attempted killing. And I want you to hear this. This is an example, a great example of what a woman can do and who a woman is that survives and has the courage to stand up against honor killings. Let's listen to Malala's speech right now on the cross in the desert.
The words the Taliban never wanted her to hear. Happy 16th birthday, Malala.
Being here with such honorable people is a great moment in my life, and it's an honor for me that today I'm wearing a shawl of Benazir Bhutto Shahid. I cannot believe how much love people have shown me. Malala Day is not my day. Today is the day of every woman, every boy, and every girl who have raised their voice for their rights. So here I stand, one girl among many. I speak not for myself, but for those without voice can be heard. On the 9th of October 2012, the Taliban shot me on the left side of my forehead. They shot my friends too. They thought that the bullet would silence us. But they failed. Weakness, fear, and hopelessness died. Strength, power, and courage was born. I do not even hate the Talib who shot me. Even if there is a gun in my hand and he stands in front of me, I would not shoot him. Be peaceful and love everyone. We realize the importance of our voice when we are silenced. In the same way, when we were in Swat, the north of Pakistan, we realized the importance of pens and books when we saw the guns. The terrorists are misusing the name of Islam and Pashtun society for their own personal benefits. Islam says it's not only each child's right to get education, rather it's their duty and responsibility. There was a time when women social activists asked men to stand up for their rights, but this time we will do it by ourselves. I'm not telling men to step away from speaking for women's rights. Rather, I'm focusing on women to be independent, to fight for themselves. So today, we call upon the world leaders to change their strategic policies in favor of peace and prosperity, that all the peace deals must protect women's and children's rights. A deal that goes against the rights of women is unacceptable. We call upon all governments to ensure free, compulsory education all over the world for every child. We cannot all succeed when half of us are held back. Our words can change the whole world. We are all together, united for the cause of education. Let us empower ourselves with the weapon of knowledge. And let us shield ourselves with unity and togetherness. Let us pick up our books and our pens. They are our most powerful weapons. One child, one teacher, one book and one pen can change the world. Education is the only solution. Education first. Thank you.
Very, very powerful speech from Malala on her birthday, her 16th birthday last July. This is a perfect example of a woman who refuses to let fear, intimidation, and attempted honor killings to stop her. She is an example for all women all over the world. I love her quote, "Our books and pens are our most important and powerful weapons," because according to the Taliban's mindset, education for a woman is anathema. It's unjustified. It's horrible. It's blasphemous. And here is a young freedom fighter for the rights of women who is an example, one powerful example, of how courage and fearlessness can overcome the fear and intimidation by those trying to destroy women in the name of honor and in the name of family. Well, we've heard some examples of women that have survived, Malala being one of them, but they carry scars around their hearts and minds for the rest of their life. And there is only one real hope for those that are survivors of honor violence, and that is to recognize the love of God, the healing grace of God, who cares very much for women all over the world, who reaches out with his arms of love to heal them from their scars. And I found this beautiful song by Plum that really talks about that healing that can take place when we abandon ourselves to the grace of God. Let's listen to Plum and Need You Now on the cross in the desert.
Well, everybody's got a story to tell, and everybody's got a wound to be healed. I wanna believe there's beauty here, 'cause oh, I get so tired of holding on.
Cross in the Desert. That is a very, very gifted lady, Plum, on a song that's actually a personal song for the difficulties in her marriage that she was going through. That is Plum, Need You Now. How many times have you heard me cry out, God? I'm sure that these women that I've talked about today have cried out to God asking why, crying out to God for why this happened to me, and yet they're alive. They are a tribute to his grace for surviving these horrible attempted honor killings. And you know, this is very a big struggle for me when I see these women that struggle, going through this, I sometimes ask God why too. What benefit is it? But yet many, many of these women come out and become strong leaders to lead other women to triumph over these circumstances. As I was exploring more about the topic of honor killing and the roots of it and how it really all comes together, that men and women have this division between each other, the superiority of the man and the lesser worth value of the woman. And yet, when you look deeply into this subject, you find out that this is a teaching within the core of Islam itself. I know I have many Muslim friends that will say to me, well, the Quran teaches the equality of men and women, but in practice, you see something completely different. Just a few years ago on the John Ankerberg show, the two brothers, Emil and Ergun Kanur, two former Muslims, talked about the issue of women and women's rights and how women are treated in Islam. And John Ankerberg asked them a question about how the root of this comes to the surface. Where does this all begin? And they talked about how men and women are separated when they go to worship at the mosque. I want you to hear their explanation for the way women are treated in Islam right now on the cross in the desert.
Emir, talk a little bit more about how the value of women versus the value of a man is seen even in the mosque and in prayer time.
You go to traditional mosque, of course, the women are in the back, and the question comes, well, why in the back? And the typical Muslim man will say modesty, but they won't quote the exactness of it. In Surah 4:43, it says you can't go to prayer if you're dirty, drunk, sick, or have touched a woman. In Bukhari's Hadith in the Sayings of Muhammad, Volume 1, Number 490, it says there are three things that interrupt prayer: a dog, a donkey, or a woman. So you see the explicit nature of what Muhammad sees in a woman, and therefore they're not only set in the back, but in many mosques, they're in a totally different arena, different building, different floor, however it's viewed. And that's the picture of a literal Islam. And to our viewers who say, well, I know of a moderate Islam, I know what goes on in places like Turkey, I'll remind them since 1980, the expansion of Islam has been into purist, militant, literal Islam every single time. And so we're watching it with Arab Spring, that democracy is now falling in North Africa, where things like if a woman leaves Islam, it used to be she would be imprisoned, re-educated. Now they're considering laws that, for example, with Egypt, 85% of Egyptians say if someone leaves Islam, man or woman, they should be put to death.
There are 1,200 mosques plus here in the United States, 80% which supposedly are supported by the Wahhabis out of Saudi Arabia, all right? What does that mean for women here in America?
The Wahhabi sect, it's a subsect, a purist movement within the Sunni Islamic world. They are the ones who are the most devout. They follow the Quran most literally. The Wahhabis who finance this, they are also the ones who train the imams. They are also the ones who will call the Muslims to prayer. They will call the Muslims together. Here is the mosque for us. There, no question, it is genetic inferiority for the female. No question for the women when they say, oh, you know, he's so religious and he lets me go to church. Once you have signed nikah, I always ask them two things. I said, number one, did you hear yourself say, he lets me? What is that? And then secondly, once you are married, the husband has all these reasons to break. A woman cannot, it is almost impossible for a woman to break talaq, to divorce the man. It's almost as if they're willingly selling themselves into slavery.
These are two former Muslim men who know what they speak about, and they're digging deeper into the reasons that women are treated in a very inferior way. One of them they quoted from the Quran and the Hadith that if you touch a woman before prayer, your prayer is nullified. Why a woman? Why is that emphasized that way? And the way they are seated in the mosque. And of course, I had a friend that said, well, that's just so that there is no distractions. But as you dig deeper and look into the Wahhabi sect, women are inferior genetically, and they're to take the Quran very literally in the way women are treated. And of course, you are familiar, I hope, with what the Quran teaches in Surah chapter 4, verse 35. I've quoted this many times on my program. If a man suspects that his wife, just suspects, that she has been unfaithful, he has three options. One, to confront her. Two, to not sleep with her. And three, and to beat her. A woman can be subjected to beating if the man even suspects that his wife has been unfaithful. So the idea that the Quran teaches the equality of men and women is just not there. When you look at the vast number of surahs and you examine things in context, you go to the hadith, it certainly does not teach what many Muslim women would teach, that they are equal with men. Now, it's wonderful if there is a Muslim couple that are not very serious and literal about the Quran, that there is a real harmonious relationship, but that is only because they have not been subjected to the deeper teachings or the more militant groups that take the Quran very literally in these passages on how women are to be treated. As we mentioned in the program earlier, there are those success stories of women who have escaped honor killings and have survived and went on to be mightily used of God. And this is the story of Amani. She's an Egyptian Muslim woman. Let's listen to her amazing story called Nowhere to Hide, right now on the cross in the desert.
The first thing I said, this cannot happen here. This is the land of freedom. They cannot reach me here. I couldn't believe it.
For more than 10 years, Amani Mustafa and her two children were on the run in the United States, hiding from her ex-husband and his brother. Amani says both had threatened to kill her if she did not return to Egypt and Islam. Amani became a Christian after reading the Bible in secret in the bathroom. When her father learned she had left Islam, he summoned her to his home.
He said, I have a straightforward question for you. Is it Islam or is it Christ? And as I was about melting, I said, it's Christ. And at this point, he got up to hit me, and he said that he's going to do this and that, and he was very threatening, and he's going to tie me to his car and make me an example to the city.
Amani fled and was in hiding for several years. She later married a Muslim who promised she could practice her Christian faith in secret. But his attitude changed after their second child was born. Amani was no longer allowed to attend church. She had to wear a veil. Still a Christian in her heart, Amani says she struggled when her husband forced her to read the Quran, the Islamic holy book, to their children.
I felt like I'm feeding my children poison. And that was the hardest thing. To know the truth and not be able to speak it.
Amani's husband agreed to send her and the children to live in the United States. He vowed to join them later. Amani says she felt a sudden sense of freedom and relief when the plane left Egyptian airspace.
First thing that went was my veil. That terrified my son as he looked at me and he said, Mom, you're going to go to hell. And I said, Son, we just left.
Once in America, Amani recommitted herself to Christ. That's when the persecution returned. When she told her husband that she was filing for divorce, he demanded the kids be brought back to Egypt and Islam. He said Amani would pay a price for her decision.
He sent his brother after us. They were listening to our conversations for myself and my family, my mom also. And there were people surveilling us, and you know, I didn't know that this could even happen.
Amani and her children fled to another state where her husband could not find them. Today, more than 10 years later, the threats have disappeared. She's no longer in hiding. Amani has moved forward publicly with her life. She feels called to serve in various ministries, reaching out to women facing Islamic oppression. She's a host of a new woman's television show that is broadcast throughout the Middle East. Amani and her co-hosts, all former Muslims, talk about their experiences with Islam.
There are so many women living under Muslim husbands or Muslim fathers or Muslim families that are living the same things that I'm living, that I lived back then. There are so many women that need to know and hear about the freedom of Christ that I experience today. Those tears are not tears of pain, but actually they are tears of appreciation, because now I know that I am saved through the grace of Christ.
Amani feels privileged to share her joy on television, and she's proud of her children. Son Joshua has become an ordained pastor. Her oldest daughter is also in ministry. Amani now enjoys a loving marriage with her American Christian husband and their daughter, Mary.
I am convinced that every experience I lived through in my life, it was to be for His glory, to be used for His glory. You see, we have a choice. Either we sit and mope and weep over our spilled milk, or we can just use the hardship and the bad experiences for His glory, and I choose to glorify God's name.
Gary Lane, CBN News.
Amani is an amazing, courageous woman that did not give up the fight. And look at what she has accomplished, her own son, an ordained pastor. She has a woman's talk show, and she is speaking out against the atrocities committed in the name of Islam, to reaching out to women who are oppressed. And she really is what Cutlass says in this song. It's an amazing song I want to feature right now called What Faith Can Do. And this song reminds me of the accomplishments of all of the women today on the cross in the desert I've talked about, especially Amani as a Christian woman. Let's listen to this tremendous song right now on the cross in the desert. In your darkest trial, you can speak to the mountain, and Jesus says that mountain will move because of your faith in him. The faith that God gives us in the darkest of trials sustains us and strengthens us. And in the case of Amani, in the case of Golmina, in the case of Saba, they all triumphed through their faith and understanding of God and his grace. What faith can do. And that is the music of Cutlass on the cross in the desert. I want to shift our focus now from the Middle Eastern part of Pakistan and Egypt and go back to Iran. And I want to share with you a heartbreaking story that occurred this week in Iran. It's actually a story I featured in my book, my newest book, The Cross in the Desert. It's the story of Mohana Ahmadi, a young 3-year-old girl, painting and drawing a picture of her father being hanged. It caught the hearts of many on the internet when she shared this little drawing. Young little girls and boys don't draw things like that. They draw happy scenes. But Mohana had to draw this sad scene. Well, it was of a consequence through much international pressure and prayer that her father was taken off of death row and the Sunni Sikhs were put back in regular prison. That was until just this past week when they were finally hanged. I want to share this powerful article written by my good friend Shadi Pave, who writes for the Gatestone Institute about this particular crime, this particular execution. Both Shadi and I had been speaking out for these 6 Sunni men for a very long time, and as I mentioned, they were not pardoned, but taken off of death row, but it was only just for a short time. Despite prolonged efforts by human rights organizations, 6 Sunni men were hanged in the early morning of March 4th, 2015, at Rajshahr prison in Iran. Hamed Amani, Kamal Mullah, Jasmin Delkhani, Jangihar Deghani, Sidji Mohammadi, and Sayyid Hadi Husani all belong to the Sunni sect of Islam, which is much persecuted by the mostly Shi'i Islamic Republic of Iran. The sister of Jasmin and Jangihar stated to the Ruzline news agency that the family were unexpectedly summoned by prison authorities for their last visit with their loved ones. The call was most unexpected. No one had any idea that the executions were to be taking place right away, not even the men themselves. We were told to go to the prison for our very last visit, so we went. The men were in iron cages with shackled hands and feet. We saw them for 10 minutes only from afar. We just looked at them. We could not touch them. This was our last visit. Their families and supporters had gathered outside the prison in hopes of halting the executions, as they had also done last June. One supporter wrote on her Facebook, quote, "I was outside prison with the families starting at 1 a.m. that night. Mrs. Deghani, the mother of the 2 men, was praying and crying. Guards were trying to get us all to leave. At dawn, when everyone was getting ready for morning prayers, an ambulance suddenly came out of the prison. It was terrifying. Were the lifeless bodies of the men in that ambulance? The families attacked the ambulance and tried to stop it to see inside. No one believed that they had actually hanged the men already. We thought it was a trick to get us to leave so they could carry out the hangings. Prison authorities told us that the bodies were being taken to the cemetery and that we should just follow the ambulance. He also threatened Mrs. Mohammadi, the mother of one of the men. We got into our cars and started following the ambulance, but were violently forced out of the car. I was taken for interrogation and was beaten badly. Many came and brought us food and blanket, but I wish many more had come, so maybe the regime would not have killed these innocent men. Sadjay Mohammadi and Syed Hadi Hassani both suffered from various psychological illnesses requiring medications. Their execution had been overturned in 2013 due to their illness, and the courts promised new trials. Instead, their death sentence was once again confirmed in May of 2014. The other 4 men, Hamed Ahmadi, Jangihar Jashani, Jamshed Deghani, and Kamal Mullah, were accused of killing a senior Sunni clerk in September 29, but their claim they were arrested several months before the killing. And Shadi writes on in her article, the charges for all 6 men were enmity of God, punishable by death in Iran's present penal code. They were among 33 Sunni men currently on death row. in Iran. All of the men maintained they were targeted solely because they practiced or promoted their faith, such as taking part in Sunni religious seminars, distributing Sunni religious reading materials, and participating in religious gatherings. One human rights activist from Iran, interviewed exclusively for Gatestone, who wishes to remain anonymous, stated, quote, "Ever since the rise of ISIS, the regime has become more brazen and has stepped up executions. Before, at least they would announce them regularly, but now they do. They do not have a care in the world. Not many countries are really paying attention to Iran's human rights much more anymore. We have had our own ISIS here for 36 years now." This is an article, a very powerful one, written by my good friend Shadi Pave in the Gatestone Institute, entitled "Scene from an Execution, Iran Executing Six Sunni Men." Now, I want to tie this to my book. I wrote in my book, "Please Don't Hang My Daddy," and this was a drawing made by Mohana Ahmadi, the daughter of Hamid Ahmadi, who was just executed, one of the six Sunni men. And I want to share with you right now a very powerful article just written by my dear friend Pamene, who is an Iranian Christian refugee in Malaysia. I feature her powerful stories here. And what she has done, she is writing this letter as a person broken over this death of her father. She's writing to Mohana herself and expressing her outrage, her brokenness over her father's death. But I want you to hear the emotion of this letter. And I want you to hear what life is going to be like now for that precious girl who made a drawing of her father being hanged, and everyone on the internet saw it. She's writing to her, "Dear Mohana, they took your father. They stole his life. They stole the precious time you could spend among his arms day and nights in the past, and precious hours you would have spent with him in the future. They stole many things in your life and left a big question mark in your small mind, a question mark with a question, why? Dear Mohana, the suffering your small soul and spirit went through was huge for your age. Still, it is nothing compared with what you will be going through in the future, asking yourself why. Dear Mohana, you must get ready for very painful days that won't let your tears drop down. The days that you will now have to show yourself happy and strong, but you will not really be. You cannot really be. You will feel pain in your heart, and you will have to hide it, asking yourself why. The first day you go to school, your father will not accompany you. He will not even see you in the school uniform. He will not even ask you to turn around and will admire you and your beauty. He will not be there to kiss you and hug you goodbye at the school date, the first day and every day, and you will ask yourself, why? At school, when others talk about their parents and their holidays, you will ask them how it feels to have a father, because you will have almost forgotten the feeling you had before the age of four. Now you are too young to remember the sweet days with your father in the future. You will tell them, my father is in heaven, honoring your father, being proud of your father, but with a deep pain in your heart, asking yourself, why? Later, when you grow up, you will find out that your father was really in the hell made by the Islamic regime in Iran. You will find out that anywhere he has gone might be heaven compared with that hell. When other children draw their parents in the garden under the sun and the blue sky, you will draw you and your mother again, looking at your father's face in the sky. For your convocation ceremony, you will have tears in your eyes when you don't find your father's arms and smiles there. How hard it will be to control your tears on the stage and in front of your mother, who will be trying to control her tears in front of you too. And you will ask yourself, why? In your wedding, it will be hard not to burst into tears when your father is not there, as if in this world only there was no space only for your father. The more you grow up, the more you will feel pain and question marks in your minds becomes bigger with the simple question, why? The pain becomes worse when you become a physician, or you see how hard many physicians work for months and years to save old patients' life, while your young, healthy, and intelligent father's life was taken without any disease. His life was taken while he might live healthy for many long years to come, and you will shout, asking the world, why, feeling injustice, oppression, and cruelty in all your life is a terrible why you cannot do anything, and you have to keep quiet while nobody will answer your big question, why? Time will never go back, and you will never have forgotten your father. The sweet days of having father will never repeat. You will not be born again to live with your father, as it has been tracing me. The dark shadow of your suffering and fears in your childhood will always trace you and follow you all your life, at your middle age, and even when you get old. Once again, you will find a way to shout out and make your voice heard by the world, asking, why? But will there be an answer? And this is Peymanet's latest story as she writes this tear-soaked letter to this precious little girl and trying to help her, yet reminding her of the pain when she goes to school without her father, when she grows up and graduates her high school without her father, when she becomes a career woman and looks back without her father and grows old without her father, asking the question, why? Well, sometimes the question why is something we cannot answer in this life. And God, in his mysterious providence and for his purposes, sometimes allows evil to happen for a reason. And yet, as much as I see the pain and many of these survivors of honor killings, I also see the beauty that God brings out of the ashes of their suffering. I wrote a book just about a year and a half ago called Beauty from the Ashes, The Promise Fulfilled. And in that book, it's the story of Hannah and Rachel being reunited after 40 years. They were Holocaust survivors. Hannah has become a Christian, and her friend Rachel has lost her faith. They both grew up in the Warsaw Ghetto in Poland. And the book was titled Beauty from the Ashes because of many pains and scars that Hannah still suffers and still has to confront now being a Christian. And I don't want to give away the storyline of that book, but I want to say this to you, that God does indeed bring beauty out of the ashes of our suffering. And he does it in many amazing ways that maybe are not something we can perceive at the moment, but he does in many ways do that. And you may be going through a struggle right now, and I want to help you with this. In the very back of my book, I wrote something to the reader about beauty from the ashes. And I want to help you with this morning. Beauty from the ashes, the heart of God. In his perfect providence, God indeed does bring beauty out of the ashes of our suffering. He is the grand weaver. He weaves together the events of our lives for his divine purpose. In the midst of our suffering, when the world seems so meaningless, God is at work weaving together the events of our lives into a beautiful tapestry. In our suffering, we don't see the big picture like God does. Instead, sometimes we question his goodness and sovereignty and recoil with bitterness and anger. Yet God assures us that he will cause everything to work together for our good because we are called for a purpose. Our sufferings and dark trials have a purpose. God is in control and beckons us to rest in his faithfulness. When we surrender our fears and anxieties and embrace our trials, only then will we have peace. You will keep in perfect peace all who trust in you, all whose thoughts are fixed on you. Isaiah chapter 26, verse 3. This is God's promise to you and me. He wants us to rest in his perfect providence and sovereignty and realize that the evil and suffering in this world will soon fade away into a paradise of ultimate joy and peace. Like Hannah, many of us spend years confronting the scars and demons of our lives. And one day, we come face to face with the, quote, big picture, the ultimate purpose. Sometimes we are privileged in this life to watch God unravel the curtain and show us why. My prayer for you, the listener, is to rest in God's faithfulness, that maybe one day he will pull back the curtain and reveal that rainbow you've been waiting to see, and then all of your suffering will find its ultimate purpose. This is what I wrote in the book, Beauty from the Ashes. I know that it's easy for me to say that, perhaps to you. Perhaps I have not endured the kind of suffering that you have. But make no mistake, God understands our pain and suffering. He understands the heartache and the sorrow that we suffer. He understands it firsthand because he himself experienced it firsthand. You see, in the God of Christianity, the God of unconditional love, he is not a distant deity far away, untouched by our pain and sorrow. In fact, the Bible says that Jesus is the man of sorrows. Jesus is the man of sorrows because he endured firsthand the suffering and the pain far beyond anything that we will ever suffer. He suffered a spiritual separation from his Father at the cross, when the sins of humanity, when our guilt and shame was laid upon him, he experienced a separation that you and I could never fathom and never understand. And that's why he could say, quoting Psalm 22 on the cross, in a death cry, he could say, my God, why have you forsaken me? You can understand when you look deeper why Jesus could utter those words. My God, why has you forsaken me? Perhaps that has been your heart's cry. Perhaps that has been the heart's cry of these women that survived the honor killings. God, why? Why have you forsaken me? What have I done? Well, in reality, Jesus took our place and uttered that death cry when he was bearing our shame and guilt. He took and paid a penalty that we should have paid. The Bible says that we are lawless, that we are lawbreakers, that all of us have broken God's holy law in our hearts, in our thoughts, in our words, in our deeds. And God, in his perfect justice, could have said, you deserve death. But instead, he showed hasid. He showed mercy to us. He showed perfect love and mercy and patience to us. The Bible is a book of God's love, of God's irresistible love, calling us back to himself. And so in our sorrow and pain, when we ask why, we should ask why not. God has a purpose in our suffering and pain. He has a purpose to bring us back to himself. He has a purpose to strengthen our faith. He has a purpose to mold and shape us. But he definitely has a purpose in pain. We can see the purpose in pain with Jesus' death on the cross. With Jesus' death and resurrection, we see the purpose in pain, and now that everyone who calls upon the name of the Lord can be saved. Why? Because we serve a risen Savior, and through his death and his tragic death on the cross, God highly exalted him and gave him the name that is above all names, that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow and every tongue confess that he is Lord. There was a purpose in his suffering and pain. And in the lives of these women that have suffered so much in honor killings, in the lives of this young little girl who ultimately saw her dad now executed, what is her life going to be like? God has a purpose in her suffering and pain. And one of those purposes is one day, I believe, and that God will bring her to faith in his son Jesus. And that she will look back on this sorrow and pain and see that God had a mysterious providence and purpose in allowing this evil to happen. No girl should ever have to grow up without her father. But one day she will meet her real father and her real heavenly father. And that is a father whose love is unconditional for little Mahana, a perfect love. Right now is very hard for little Mahana to understand. She took a crayon one day and in her best way tried to describe the evil and the suffering around her, and she made a picture of her father being hanged. And that's hard. That's so difficult for that young child to understand. And so today I ask for your prayers and thoughts for little Mahana, who this week had to say goodbye to her father. Let us pray that God will give Mahana great comfort and grace, will give Mahana's mother great comfort and grace, and that God would work in this trial, in this suffering, to bring good out of it, to bring beauty out of the ashes of their suffering. Please keep this dear little child in your prayers. That is what you and I can do. She drew her father being hanged. She's crying out to you and me with the picture, this drawing. And our response would be to wrap our arms of love and prayers around little Mahana and her mother. Prayer is a mighty, mighty, gracious gift that God has given us. That when we cry out to God for justice and comfort in this situation, I believe that He hears our prayers and that He will answer it. If you have a heart cry for justice in your suffering, know that God hears the cries of your heart, and He will answer your prayers, and He will answer your cries. And I want to close with this beautiful quote from the Psalms that I pray every day for my Iranian friends. It's Psalm 72, verses 12 through 14. It cries out, "He will rescue the poor when they cry to Him. He will help the oppressed who have no one to defend them. He feels pity for the weak and the needy, and He will rescue them. He will redeem them from oppression and violence, for their lives are precious to Him." Your life is precious to God. He will rescue you when you cry to Him. He will help you when you have no one around you to defend you. He understands your weakness and your needs. He will come to your rescue. He will redeem you from oppression and violence because your life is precious to Him. That is a promise from God's word to you. And that is what I pray for Mahana and her mother. That is what I pray for Malala. That is what I pray for Amani. And that is what I pray for Gulmina, in that particular prayer from the Psalms. Make this your prayer for my Iranian friends today, Psalm 72, verses 12 through 14. I believe with all my heart God will answer the cries of your heart for them that suffer oppression and violence every day behind the Islamic curtain of Iran. I want to thank you so much, Mary, for visiting me today on the Cross in the Desert. Mary is a faithful listener. I pray God's grace and blessing and peace in your life, dear Mary. Thank you, everyone who listened to the Cross in the Desert today. I will be back, hopefully, this Thursday for another program. I want you to have an incredible week and keep my dear friends in your thoughts and prayers. God bless you, and I will see you on the next edition of the Cross in the Desert. Have a fantastic week.